Here we have arrived, dear friends, at the chapter on Raja Yoga, the final chapter in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, unrevised by Sri Aurobindo after its publication in the Arya on 15 March 1918. Well, let's talk a bit about Raja Yoga before we come to the chapter, actually. The term is old, nearly 1,000 years old, probably originates around the 11th century in the Amanaska Tantric Shaiva work. So it comes from the Kaula tradition, significantly in the Konkan countryside of Karnataka, which, by the way, is where Sri M.P. Pandit and Vasanti Rao are from, and others who were close to us. So it is an ancient heritage and appears in this tradition in which samadhi is a goal, looking to place the aspiring yogin into a state of union with the aspectless Shiva. But it was not a yoga that aimed at simple residing in this superconscious state, aloof and away from the world, but rather promoted the idea of jivan mukti, to be liberated in life and to live full of power, full of light, here in a body as if a god. And one can see that in the Yoga Bija, the Yoga Bija, as well as in early four or five of these Shaiva Tantric works, which describe this as being the king of four yogas. There's the Laya Yoga, Mantra Yoga, Hatha Yoga, and finally this. This is the supreme state. By the time we see it fully articulated a few centuries later, by the 15th or 16th century, which is about when we see the Hatha Pradipika come into being. What is considered to be the masterwork on Hatha Yoga, which regards itself as a preliminary to the practice of the Raja Yoga. And all the way back to the Amanaska, this idea of what is the Raja is to put you in union with the Supreme Person inside, with whom you are identical. So while it is aspectless, why, you know, this thing which is infinite cannot be confined in any particular form. It can assume a form that is pleasing to you as a means of introducing itself, but one must finally be able to exceed all forms and live in this conditionless, aspectless reality. Conscious, full of regnant power, and secure above all things. So this is a very different goal than what we see described in the Yoga Sutras, which has as at its apex, when it points you to samadhi, it means to realize and withdraw oneself from the world. So these two are not the same. The Yoga Sutras do not equate with Raja Yoga. Well, they were not equated until Swami Vivekananda in the late 19th century, looking for texts with which he could instruct Western disciples, came upon the Yoga Sutras, which had not really been read for about the last 1,000 years, and promoted it. It became wildly popular in the West, and then, because it was popular in the West, became popular in India. And so here we go. So now he equates the Yoga Sutras with Raja Yoga. And so to this day, you will find that there's often this connotation. But as we look here at Sri Aurobindo's treatment, he doesn't, even though he's a great admirer of Swami Vivekananda, he doesn't quite embrace that perspective. And it'll probably take 2 weeks of reading slowly to get through it all. But Sri Aurobindo's goal is always this worldly. And he seems to conceive that there is present in the scheme of Raja Yoga this series of worlds stacked one upon the other through which one can find conversations through the chakras as they awaken, so that you can learn to live in these inner planes of the cosmos. This is very interesting because it does link the worlds together. And there is this idea of descent, which is possible in Raja Yoga, but not desirable in the Yoga Sutras. For Sri Aurobindo, finally, even Raja Yoga will not be brought into his larger system of practice. Remember, the Yoga of Divine Works, the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, the Yoga of Divine Love, and finally, the Yoga of Self-Perfection. He leaves to the side both Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga from his system, because the one is too focused on the external and the other too focused on the internal. He is looking for a balance and an integration. He is looking to bring that higher consciousness into the physical, but on the way, transforming mind, transforming life. So for Sri Aurobindo, it is easier to see the synthetic approach of the Bhagavad Gita, the Trimarga as expressed there, as the ground from which we rise to the integral yoga which he conceives. So having said that, I think it's enough of an introduction. And if something has been overlooked, we'll bring it up next time. So chapter 28, Raja Yoga. As the body and the prana are the key of all the closed doors of the yoga for the Hatha Yogin, so is the mind the key in Raja Yoga. But since in both, the dependence of the mind on the body and the prana is admitted in the Hatha Yoga totally, in the established system of Raja Yoga partially. Therefore, in both systems, the practice of asana and pranayama is included. But in the one, they occupy the whole field. In the other, each is limited only to one simple process. And in their unison, they are intended to serve only a limited and intermediate office. We can easily see how largely man, even though in his being an embodied soul, is in his earthly nature, the physical and vital being, and how, at first sight at least, his mental activities seem to depend almost entirely on his body and his nervous system. Modern science and psychology have even held for a time this dependence to be in fact an identity. They have tried to establish that there is no such separate entity as mind or soul, and that all mental operations are in reality physical functionings. Well, the argument continues, does it not? Modern psychology, materialistic in its emphasis, has not surrendered ground to our side, and we have not surrendered ground to them. Even otherwise, apart from this untenable hypothesis, the dependence is so exaggerated that it has been supposed to be an altogether binding condition. And any such thing as the control of the vital and bodily functions by the mind, or its power to detach itself from them, has long been treated as an error, a morbid state of the mind, or a hallucination. Therefore, the dependence has remained absolute, and science neither finds nor seeks for the real key of the dependence, and therefore can discover for us no secret of release and mastery. So the dependence he speaks of here is the dependence of mind on the body and on the life force, on prana. And of course we see in studies published as recently as 3 days back, a focus of modern psychology on the mapping of the neural network in the brain and finding neuronal links that, if stimulated, lead to a particular experience. And of course, David Chalmers, I'll never be able to say this name tonight, Chalmers and others, will argue back, well, it is only the physical incidence or coincidence of the consciousness finding registration in the physical, and you can't disprove otherwise. Well, it's the mind-body problem. It's the big problem, as we like to call it, the hard problem. And we're at loggerheads. And since the Australians became dominant in the philosophy of mind in the 1950s, they have seemed to be winning. And yet, the game has not been played. Sri Aurobindo's point is that the consciousness released from confinement to body and life force can very well reverse the sense of dependence and install upon the life its ideation, impose upon the body its perfecting will, and reverse the order. You see, he will say that the roots of true being are above, not below. We don't rise really out of matter. We descend from above into matter and then climb back from there. Hence the power of evolution, the self-seeking of the cosmos. It's embedded in the very manifestation of being. Back to his essay here. The psychophysical science of yoga does not make this mistake. It seeks for the key, finds it, and is able to effect the release, for it takes account of the psychical or mental body behind, of which the physical is a sort of reproduction in gross form, and is able to discover thereby secrets of the physical body which do not appear to a purely physical inquiry. To translate that into Sanskritic terminology, the stula sharira, the external body, is a reflection in matter of the sukshma sharira, the inner body, which participates or can participate in the immortality the imperishable physical within, so that this body, grossly expressed, is a contingent formulation of this inside. The discontinuance of the physical, in the gross sense, need not terminate the inner subtle body if one becomes awake. Otherwise, it too goes back to the natural constituents of the cosmos from which it came, because the cosmos is not simply the material face of the universe, but has inner dimensions. The question is, does the consciousness wish to impose on the form a relative immortality, an imperishability? It has to muster that mastery, but it can so do. Back to Sri Aurobindo, this mental or psychical body, which the soul keeps even after death, has also a subtle pranic force in it, corresponding to its own subtle nature and substance. For wherever there is life of any kind, there must be the pranic energy and a substance in which it can work. And this force is directed through a system of numerous channels called nadi, the subtle nervous organization of the psychic body, which are gathered up into six or really seven centers called technically lotuses or circles, chakra, and which rise in an ascending scale to the summit where there is the thousand-petaled lotus from which all the mental and vital energy flows. So these are studded upwards from the Muladhara through the Swadhisthana through, oh, Manipura, and then the Anahata, then Vishuddha, and then Agnya, and then finally the Sahasrara above. Sri Aurobindo says that there are six here. Goraksha, I think, originally spoke of nine, and there are other tantric theories in which there are as many as 16. And not all of them are they arranged in ascending order. Sometimes they seem to be related to organs of the body. So, but the general idea is that they all exist inwardly in inner domains and represent planar realities, which have their center in you as well. Nadis are translated here as channels, but they're also like straws, tubes, tiny tubes that you can blow the stuff out and then things can move, circulate in and out of. So they come into and out of the various chakras and feed into this enormous system. Sri Aurobindo is not apparently going to go into a detailed examination. He would probably require some materials there. At the time he's writing this, I don't think John Woodruff's books had really been popularized in English. Or if so, they must have just been coming up. We can check that. This arrangement of the psychic body Wait, I don't think I finished that paragraph. Each of these lotuses is the center and the storing house of its own particular system of psychological powers, energies, and operations, each system corresponding to a plane of our psychological existence. And these flow out and return in the stream of the pranic energies as they course through the nadis. This arrangement of the psychic body is reproduced in the physical with the spinal column as a rod and the ganglionic centers as the chakras, which rise up from the bottom of the column, where the lowest is attached to the brain and find their summit in the Brahmarandra at the top of the skull. That means like the crevice of Brahma, you know, as he enters into or departs. That's the passage through which this consciousness of the Creator God moves. These chakras or lotuses, however, are in physical man closed or only partly open, with the consequence that only such powers and only so much of them are active in him as are sufficient for his ordinary physical life, and so much mind and soul only is at play as will accord with its need. This is the real reason, looked at from the mechanical point of view, why the embodied soul seems so dependent on the bodily and nervous life, though the dependence is neither so complete nor so real as it seems. The whole energy of the soul is not at play in the physical body and life. The secret powers of mind are not awake in it. The bodily and nervous energies predominate. But all the while, the supreme energy is there, asleep. It is said to be coiled up and slumbering like a snake. Therefore, it is called the Kundalini Shakti in the lowest of the chakras, in the Muladhara, the root chakra. Note what is not said here is that as above, so below. So if there's a below, there must be an above. So Kundalini below is coiled up and asleep. Above, it is Mahakundali. And she is awake. She is the great power of yogic force, conscient, irresistible. And she is keeping her eye on her sleeping twin below. And when the one below rises, who is it that she meets at the top? Mahakundali, descending. Ha! There's the nexus. Now we have a concourse going up, and we have a return passage coming down. When, by pranayama, the division between the upper and lower prana currents in the body is dissolved, this kundalini is struck and awakened. It uncoils itself and begins to rise upward like a fiery serpent, breaking open each lotus as it ascends until the Shakti meets the Purusha in the Brahmarandra in a deep samadhi of union. Yes, that union is the goal. Now, this all arises out of the tantric practice. Any tantric guru worth his salt will insist that the aspirant be trained and made ready and be prepared so that when this kundalini is stirred from below, when prana shakti striking against it again and again sparks it into wakefulness, that as that kundalini rises, it must come at least to the anahata chakra. It must rise at least this far. Otherwise, what happens is that enormous appetites, ungovernable energies are released, and there can be a catastrophe in the practice of the yoga. So he has to be there with the shishya, with the disciple, ensuring that this rising consciousness gets here. If it can go farther, if it can awaken the throat chakra, one becomes inspired in the external moving speech, becomes mellifluous. Still higher, one gets to the command center, the Ajna Chakra, and then vision becomes profound, insightful, really penetrates. But when it rises to where you meet the infinite, ha, there's Mahakundali waiting, and one enters disrobed, naked in spirit, living largely in that. But one can return. One need not simply be above. The idea of that coming down can be achieved. That, too, the guru must help to effect in the tantric practice. Put less symbolically, in more philosophical, though perhaps less profound language, this means that the real energy of our being is lying asleep and inconscient in the depths of our vital system and is awakened by the practice of pranayama. Remember, this is something one takes up after having established oneness in the body, that the body can sit stable and not spill the energy that's going to come into it. And then one learns how to lift the breath slowly, how to bring the breath back down, how to circulate the breath, how to suspend the breath, how to come into communion with prana without reliance on physical breath. This is the practice of pranayama. And often these days, in the West especially, the practice focuses so much on mastery of the asanas that rarely does one get introduced properly to the practice of this pranayama. It is the secret for stilling the mind, because if you cannot bring a calm and equitable force of life into composition, your mind will be unsteady. In its expansion, it opens up all the centers of our psychological being in which reside the powers and the consciousness of what would now be called, perhaps, our subliminal self. Remember how he's used this term, subliminal, behind the line, below the line. What he means, really, in his terminology, is what is behind the surface. So this refers to the whole of the inner cosmos and what might be your being. Therefore, as each center of power and consciousness is opened up, because you have centers of power and consciousness all up this chain of being, therefore, as each center of power and consciousness is opened up, we get access to successive psychological planes and are able to put ourselves in communication with the worlds or cosmic states of being which correspond to them. It's not just all about you, it's about that too, the world writ large. All the psychic powers, abnormal to physical man, but natural to the soul, develop in us. Finally, at the summit of the ascension, this arising and expanding energy meets with the superconscient self above the line of consciousness, which sits concealed behind and above our physical and mental existence. He's just given you a clue. To find that, you have to go inside and then rise in consciousness. This meeting leads to a profound samadhi of union in which our waking consciousness loses itself in the superconscient. Well, that is the typical thing that happens. We'll see that Sri Aurobindo will not permit that we will experience a laya of consciousness simply because we cross this line. No, we have to become conscious there, fully aware, and not lapse into some state in which, oh, I don't exist, you don't exist, there's nothing here, I may as well vacate. Nuh-uh. Thus, by the thorough and unremitting practice of pranayama, The Hatha Yogin attains in his own way the psychic and spiritual results which are pursued through more directly psychical and spiritual methods in other yogas. The one mental aid which he conjoins with it is the use of the mantra, sacred syllable, name, or mystic formula, which is of so much importance in the Indian systems of yoga and common to them all, especially in the practice of Tantra. This secret of the power of the mantra, the six chakras, and the Kundalini Shakti is one of the central truths of all that complex psychophysical science and practice of which the Tantric philosophy claims to give us a rationale and the most complete compendium of methods. All religions and disciplines in India which use largely the psychophysical method depend more or less upon it for their practices. This is true, and you can go beyond that and say that the religious observances in India these days are no longer really Vedic in orientation, they are Tantric. Raja Yoga also uses the pranayama and for the same principle, psychic purposes as the Hatha Yoga, but being in its whole principle a psychical system, that is, inside, psychological, it employs it only as one stage in the series of its practices and to a very limited extent for three or four large utilities. It does not start with asana and pranayama, but insists first on a moral purification of the mentality. This preliminary is of supreme importance. Without it, the course of the rest of the Raja Yoga is likely to be troubled, marred, and full of unexpected mental, moral, and physical perils. Let's read the footnote. In modern India, people attracted to yoga but picking up its processes from books or from persons only slightly acquainted with the matter often plunge straight into pranayama of Raja Yoga, frequently with disastrous results. Only the very strong in spirit can afford to make mistakes in this path. Well, if you are familiar with Sri Aurobindo's personal life, you know this occurred with him. He was practicing pranayama several hours every day, and then something disrupted his practice, probably political life, and he had to discontinue abruptly and fell sick, desperately sick, so sick that they thought he might pass away. He did recover, and there's a yogic lesson in that too, and a wonderful story, but we'll save that for another evening. This idea of preliminaries, though, he'll take up in just a moment. This moral purification is divided in the established system under two heads, five yamas and five niyamas. And of course, we're familiar with those in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, but they also occur in other works, Buddhist and not, Tantric as well. So here's what he says about the yamas. The first are rules of moral self-control and conduct, such as truth-speaking, abstinence from injury or killing, from theft, etc. But in reality, these must be regarded as merely certain main indications of the general need of moral self-control and purity. Yama is, more largely, any self-discipline by which the rajasic egoism and its passions and desires in the human being are conquered and quieted into perfect cessation. Because in our personal style of life, we impact things around. The first thing we do is begin to regulate our behavior. And that's what the yamas do. Ahimsa, non-injury. Don't hurt another. And not simply physically. These have psychological roots, yes? Satya, speak only the truth. Asteya, don't reach out and claim something for yourself, as if things must be yours or not yours. Brahmacharya, that is to govern yourself, your passions, your life energies, such that your path leads you to that real Brahman. Aparigraha, so that you're not grasping things. The niyamas, he writes, are equally a discipline of the mind by regular practices of which the highest is meditation on the divine being, and their object is to create a sattvic calm, purity, and preparation for concentration upon which the secure pursuance of the rest of the yoga can be founded. So these niyamas are shaucha, purity. Again, not physical purity so much. Yes, you may bathe, but to keep your mind and heart clean and clear. Your body uplifted. Santosha, to be content, not to be restless, constantly trying to gain access, to gain acquisitions. Tapas, to be willing to work hard, to put the force of energy into your practice of yoga. Swadhyaya, not so much the reading of books, but the study of yourself, the study of your own energies. Of what are you composed? How is it that the mind works like this? Why does the heart tilt towards that? And then what he described as meditation on the divine being, Ishvara Pranidhana, to perceive that. Yes, not an abstract. It may be without aspect, but it is a conscious being whose nature is delight. Satchit Ananda. So I think we'll pause there and take up the balance of the chapter next week. And this is a section which I think we read about a year ago from Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Rio. I know, interesting that I would go to this chapter, huh? But you'll see why. Page 664. A mighty transformation came on her. A halo of the indwelling deity, the immortal's luster that had lit her face and tinted its radiance in her body's house, overflowing made the air a luminous sea. In a flaming moment of apocalypse, the incarnation thrust aside its veil. A little figure in infinity yet stood and seemed the eternal's very house. As if the world's center was her very soul, and all wide space was but its outer robe, a curve of the calm hauteur of far heaven, descending into earth's humility, her forehead span vaulted the omniscient's gaze. Her eyes were two stars that watched the universe. The power that from her being summit reigned, the presence chambered in lotus secrecy, came down and held the center in her brow, where the mind's lord in his control room sits. There, throned on concentration's native seat, he opens that third mysterious eye in man, the unseen's eye that looks at the unseen, when light with a golden ecstasy fills his brain, and the eternal's wisdom drives his choice, and eternal will seizes the mortal's will. It stirred in the lotus of her throat of song, and in her speech throbbed the immortal word. Her life sounded with the steps of the world's soul, moving in harmony with the cosmic thought. As glides God's Son into the mystic cave, where hides his light from the pursuing gods, it glided into the lotus of her heart, and woke in it the force that alters fate. It poured into her navel's lotus depth, lodged in the little life nature's narrow home. On the body's longings grew heaven rapture's flower, and made desire a pure celestial flame. Broke into the cave where coiled world energy sleeps, and smote the thousand-hooded serpent force that blazing towered and clasped the world self above, joined matter's dumbness to the spirit's hush, and filled earth's acts with the spirit's silent power. Thus changed, she waited for the word to speak. Eternity looked into the eyes of death, and darkness saw God's living reality. Namaste. Jai Ma.